change amongst the merchants, who hurried up and down, and chinked the money in their pockets, and conversed in groups, and looked at their watches, and trifled thoughtfully with their great gold seals, and so forth, that Scrooge had seen them often. The spirit stopped beside one little knot of businessmen. Observing that the hand was pointed to them, Scrooge advanced to listen to their talk.
"No,"
said a great fat man with a monstrous chin.
"I don't know much about it either way. I only know he's dead."
"When did he die?"
inquired another.
"Last night, I believe."
"Why, what was the matter with him?"
asked a third, taking a vast quantity of stuff out of a very large snuff box.
"I thought he'd never die."
"God knows,"
said the first with a yawn.
"What has he done with his money?"
asked a red-faced man with a pendulous excrescence on the end of his noose that shook like the gills of a turkey-cock.
"I haven't heard,"
said the man with the large chin, yawning.
"Left it to his company, perhaps. He hasn't left it to me. That's all I know."
This pleasantry was received with a general laugh.
"It's likely to be a very cheap funeral,"
said the same speaker.
"For upon my life, I don't know anybody to go to it.
Suppose we make up a party and volunteer."
"I don't mind going if a lunch is provided,"
observed the gentleman with the excrescence on his noose.
"But I must be fed if I make one."
Another laugh.
"Well, I am the most disinterested among you, after all,"
said the first speaker,
"for I never wear black gloves and I never eat lunch. But I'll offer to go if anybody else will. When I come to think of it, I'm not at all sure that I wasn't his most particular friend, for we used to stop and speak whenever we met. Bye-bye."
Speakers and listeners strolled away and mixed with other groups. Scrooge knew the men and looked towards the spirit for an explanation. The phantom glided on into a street. Its fingers pointed to two persons meeting. Scrooge listened again, thinking that the explanation might lie here. He knew these men also perfectly. They were men of business, very wealthy and of great importance. He had made a point of always standing well in their esteem, in a business point of view, that is, strictly in a business point of view.
"How are you?"
said one.
"How are you?" returned the other.
"Well,"
said the first.
"Old Scratch has got his own last, hey?"
"So I'm told,"
returned the second.
"Cold, isn't it?"
"Seasonable for Christmas time."
"You are not a skater, I suppose?"
"No, no. Something else to think of. Good morning."
Not another word. That was their meeting, their conversation, and their parting. Scrooge was at first inclined to be surprised that the spirit should attach importance to conversations apparently so trivial. But, feeling assured that they must have some hidden purpose, he set himself to consider what it was likely to be. They could scarcely be supposed to have any bearing on the death of Jacob, his old partner, for that was past, and this ghost province was the future. Nor could he think of any one immediately connected with himself to whom he could apply them, but nothing doubting that to whomsoever they applied they had some latent moral for his own improvement, he resolved to treasure up every word he heard and everything he saw, and especially to observe the shadow of himself when it appeared. For he had an expectation that the conduct of his future self would give him the clue he missed, and would render the solution of these riddles easy. He looked about in that very place for his own image, but another man stood in his accustomed corner, and though the clock pointed to his usual time of day for being there, he saw no likeness of himself among the multitudes that poured in through the porch. It gave him little surprise, however, for he had been revolving in his mind a change of life, and thought and hoped he saw his new-born resolution carried out in this. Quiet and dark beside him stood the phantom, with its outstretched hand. When he roused himself from his thoughtful quest, he fancied from the turn of the hand, and its situation in reference to himself, that the unseen eyes were looking at him keenly. It made him shudder and feel very cold. They left the busy scene and went into an obscure part of the town, where Scrooge had never penetrated before, although he recognized its situation and its bad repute. The ways were foul and narrow, the shops and houses wretched, the people half-naked, drunken, slipshod, ugly. Alleys and archways, like so many cesspools, disgorged their offences of smell and dirt and life upon the straggling streets, and the whole quarter reeked with crime, with filth and misery. Far in this den of infamous resort there was a low-browed beetling shop, below a penthouse roof, where iron, old rags, bottles, bones, and greasy offal were bought. Upon the floor within were piled up heaps of rusty keys, nails, chains, hinges, files, scales, weights, and refuse iron of all kinds. Secrets that few would like to scrutinize were bred and hidden in mountains of unseemly rags, masses of corrupted fat, and sepulchres of bones. Sitting in among the wares he dealt in, by a charcoal stove made of old bricks, was a gray-haired rascal, nearly 70 years of age, who had screened himself in from the cold air by a frowsy curtaining of miscellaneous tatters hung upon a line, and smoked his pipe in all the luxury of calm retirement. Scrooge and the Phantom came into the presence of this man, just as a woman with a heavy bundle slunk into the shop. But she had scarcely entered when another woman, similarly laden, came in too, and she was closely followed by a man in faded black, who was no less startled by the sight of them than they had been upon the recognition of each other. After a short period of blank astonishment, in which the old man with the pipe had joined them, they all three burst into a laugh.
"Let the chairwoman alone to be the first," cried she who had entered first. "Let the laundress alone to be the second, and let the undertaker's man alone to be the third. Look here, old Joe, here's a chance. If we hadn't all three met here without meaning it."
"You couldn't have met in a better place,"
said old Joe, removing his pipe from his mouth.
"Come into the parlor. You were made free of it long ago, you know, and the other two ain't strangers. Stop till I shut the door of the shop. Ah, how it squeaks! There ain't such a rusty bit of metal in this place as its own hinge, I believe, and I'm sure there's no such old bones here as mine. We're all suitable to our calling. We're all matched. Come into the parlor. Come into the parlor."
The parlor was the space behind the screen of rags. The old man raked the fire together with an old stair-rod, and having trimmed his smoky lamp, for it was night, with the steam of his pipe, put it into his mouth again. While he did this, the woman who had already spoken threw her bundle on the floor and sat down in a flaunting manner on a stool, crossing her elbows on her knees and looking with a bold defiance at the other two.
"What odds, then, what odds, Mrs. Dilber?"
said the woman.
"Every person has a right to take care of themselves. He always did."
"That's true, indeed,"
said the laundress.
"No man more so."
"Why, then, don't stand staring as if you were afraid, woman. Who's the wiser? We're not going to pick holes in each other's coats, I suppose."
"No, indeed,"
said Mrs. Dilber and the man together.
"We should hope not."
"Very well, then,"
cried the woman.
"That's enough. Who's the worse for the loss of a few things like these? Not a dead man, I suppose."
"No, indeed,"
said Mrs. Dilber, laughing.
"If he wanted to keep 'em after he was dead, a wicked old screw,"
pursued the woman.
"Why, wasn't he natural in his lifetime? If he had been, he'd have had somebody to look after him when he was struck with death, instead of lying gasping out his last there, alone, by himself."
"It's the truest word that ever were spoke," said Mrs. Dilber. "It's a judgment on him."
"I wish it was a little heavier judgment," replied the woman. "And it should have been, you may depend upon it, if I could have laid my hands on anything else. Open that bundle, old Joe, and let me know the value of it. Speak out plain. I'm not afraid to be the first, nor afraid for them to see it. We knew pretty well that we were helping ourselves before we met here, I believe. It's no sin. Open the bundle, Joe."
But the gallantry of her friends would not allow of this, and the man in faded black, mounting the breach first, produced his plunder.
It was not extensive. A seal or two, a pencil case, a pair of sleeve buttons, and a brooch of no great value were all.
They were severely examined and appraised by old Joe, who chalked the sums he was disposed to give for each upon the wall, and added them up into a total when he found that there was nothing more to come.
"That's your account,"
said Joe.
"And I wouldn't give another sixpence if I was to be boiled for not doing it. Who's next?"
Mrs. Dilber was next. Sheets and towels, a little wearing apparel, two old-fashioned silver teaspoons, a pair of sugar tongs, and a few boots. Her account was stated on the wall in the same manner.
I always give too much to ladies. It's a weakness of mine, and that's the way I ruin myself,"
said old Joe.
"That's your account. If you asked me for another penny and made it an open question, I'd repent of being so liberal and knock off half a crown."
"And now undo my bundle, Joe."